Hi, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2025, and this is episode 457, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the film in theaters now called Fantastic Four First Steps. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He's a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written a film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Family First, a film review of the Fantastic Four First Steps, and you can read it for free at equip.org. Cole, it's glad to have you on again.
Always good to be here.
Well, this is the last of the big blockbusters that we're covering for the Postmodern Realities podcast, and that is the new Marvel film, which is called The Fantastic Four, which is currently in theaters now. Of course, as I noted, this will be spoiler-filled. So I don't know that much about Marvel very much before going into this film. I did not know anything about the Fantastic Four, and I'd like you to tell us about it because it does give a super brief origin story, but I felt like when the movie opens, I'm just dropped into a reality where there is the Fantastic Four. So who are they and what is their story? How did they become the Fantastic Four?
So for anybody who knows sort of old school comic book stuff, the Fantastic Four is one of the foundational, you know, one of the most iconic superhero teams in comic book history. And nowadays, the Fantastic Four is often credited with kickstarting what we sort of now think of as the modern Marvel Universe. Created by Stan Lee, the iconic Stan Lee, and the artist Jack Kirby, Fantastic Four made its debut in 1961, published by Marvel Comics. And at the time, superhero comics were in a bit of a slump. You know, you're in this is the Silver Age of comic books. And Lee and Kirby were trying to do something new. When we talked about Superman, you know, we sort of went through the brief history of comic books and sort of what the ages were and that kind of a thing, and how they, you know, people just sort of look back on it now and roughly date things. I mean, it's all kind of arbitrary, but you know, the golden age action comics, you know, Batman makes his debut, sort of unequivocally belong to what we now think of as sort of like the core DC characters. And here in the Silver Age, Lee and Kirby were trying to do something new. They were trying to do something a little bit more grounded, if you will, in human emotion. And so the core team, the Fantastic Four, is made up of four characters: Reed Richards, or Mr. Fantastic, his wife Sue Storm, who's the Invisible Woman, her sort of, you know, hot-headed, no pun intended, brother Johnny Storm, who was sort of an updated version of this original Marvel superhero called the Human Torch, and then Reed's best friend, this guy named Ben Grimm, who's the Thing. The Thing is sort of the iconic Fantastic Four character, the big rock monster looking thing. So the story goes, you know, they gain their powers after being exposed to cosmic radiation during a space mission. Comic books loved this idea of, you know, some type of radiation transforming you, the Hulk, Fantastic Four, things like that. Reed sort of becomes super stretchy. His anatomy is vastly changed. Sue can turn invisible and can sort of generate these force fields. Johnny can burst into flames and flies, and Ben becomes, again, you know, this rock-skinned powerhouse. But what made the Fantastic Four different wasn't just their powers. It was their dynamic. They bickered like a real family. They had arguments. They got on each other's nerves. But they still had to find a way to save the world. And that blend of soap opera with science fiction was, you know, in its day was kind of revolutionary. And historically, in those early days, Fantastic Four sort of became the bedrock, if you will, of Marvel's storytelling. And their early issues introduced characters and concepts that became pillars of the Marvel universe. Not least of all, Doctor Doom, who, you know, is sort of where the current Marvel Cinematic Universe is building to Doctor Doom. Galactus, Silver Surfer, who was in this most recent film. The group, the Inhumans, the Skrulls, if you're familiar with the sort of the alien creatures in Marvel, and even Wakanda and Black Panther, all originated in Fantastic Four comics. And so, you know, the Fantastic Four has sort of been hailed as Marvel's first family. You'll see that a lot, you know, the first family of Marvel. And not just because it has that sort of familial tone, but because it literally came first in terms of defining what Marvel's interconnected universe would become. So over the decades, the Fantastic Four have gone through highs and lows, like so many of these other, you know, comic book properties. You're talking about storytelling over, you know, quite literally decades, both in their personal stories and in their publishing history. At their peak, especially during the 60s and the 80s, they were considered, you know, Marvel's flagship title. But later years, as you move into the modern era, began to see shifts in creative teams and changing tastes. And while they never disappeared, you know, they sort of took a back seat to characters like X-Men or Spider-Man. That said, their influence, of course, remains massive. They've always embodied this sort of sense of exploration and optimism, which comes through in this film. Reed Richards is much more of a scientist than a soldier, and the team often deals with, you know, this like interdimensional travel, cosmic threats, moral questions, which is, you know, usually very different from the traditional Marvel flair, which is a lot of street level crime fighting, and things like that. That the Fantastic Four is very much big picture kind of stuff. And in a broader cultural sense, and this is probably why they're a little less known to just general audiences, they're kind of the Marvel team that got left behind a little in the cinematic explosion. Rights issues kept them with 20th Century Fox for years, and that resulted in a series of films that really didn't quite capture their essence. There were some early 2000s Fantastic Four movies that some people probably still remember. There was one in 2015 that the less said about, the better. It's the failure that has kept Josh Trank in Hollywood's director's jail for a decade now. But now with the rights back under Marvel Studios, there's sort of this renewed sense of anticipation that is paid off with this new film, which is why the return of the Fantastic Four has come with such fanfare, because of their importance to Marvel and the fact that they've been out of the MCU for so long. So, to sum it all up, you know, they're a superhero team, yes, but they're also this pioneering group, and their adventures blend family drama and science fiction. But really what makes them so important is that their history is inseparable from the rise of Marvel Comics as a storytelling powerhouse. There is a sense in which, if not for the Fantastic Four, you would not have Marvel today. So that's kind of their history and why they're important to the medium.
I was going to ask you about this because you mentioned some of the previous incarnations of the Fantastic Four films, because this one has, it's been a decade since the last one came out to pretty terrible reviews. I don't know if people remember that incarnation of the Fantastic Four. That was the one with Miles Teller in it. And also Michael B. Jordan. Those are probably the two most known. But even before that, like 20 years ago, there was the first incarnation of films back when Jessica Alba was young and not running her big businesses for mother products for moms and kids and stuff. And she was in the one 20 years ago. And then they did a sequel to that one based on some of the elements that are in this movie, which was kind of interesting. I mean, Marvel's never been on my radar, but I do remember the Silver Surfer because that was very iconic from back then. And then in this one, I noticed that they had the Silver Surfer again, which, you know, again, I don't know that much about Marvel Comics, but thought, oh, they repeated this again because they had already done a movie about the Silver Surfer and Galactus before. So what makes this, you know, besides the rights issue, how is this adaptation different from, you know, the two other sets of films, particularly the one that completely bombed 10 years ago, the one with Miles Teller and Michael B. Jordan?
Yeah, so it's sort of interesting. There are two previous major incarnations of these characters that you've mentioned. There's also a third, and it's worth mentioning this for just a second. There is, and this is sort of, I guess, to an extent, what the kids today would call lore, right? There's some Fantastic Four adaptation lore here. Way back in the late 80s through the 90s, you know, Marvel had some kind of, you know, a bit of a record with adapting certain properties. Bill Bixby's The Incredible Hulk, for example, had finished its run. And so there was a, you know, sort of an interest in trying to adapt certain properties as a result of the success of that show. And at the time, Constantine Films acquired the rights to the Fantastic Four back in the 80s, in the late 80s. And Roger Corman, who was a very well-known filmmaker, you know, he was a mentor to Francis Ford Coppola, Ron Howard, Scorsese, Dante, Joe Dante, John Sayles, James Cameron. He was this sort of a major figure in what's called the New Hollywood movement. Roger Corman was hired to produce a low-budget version of the Fantastic Four. And that was scheduled to release in 1994, but the film was never actually released. There's a whole story behind this I won't get into, and you can read about all that drama. But it's kind of taken on this mythic status, right? This unreleased Fantastic Four film from the 90s. So there was that adaptation that never saw the light of day. Then in 2005, as you mentioned, you had the version that was directed by Tim Story, where Ian Grufford was Reed Richards, Jessica Alba was Sue Storm. It had a very young Chris Evans as Johnny Storm, and the Thing was played by Michael Chiklis, who was very prominent for his role in the television series The Shield. And with those two movies, The Fantastic Four 2005 and Rise of the Silver Surfer in 2007, those sort of became the well-known Fantastic Four adaptations, and for a while were the definitive take. There were diminishing box office returns in those, unfortunately. What is interesting about that 2005 adaptation is that it was originally speculated the film would be a period piece set in the 60s, which we get with this new adaptation, but of course that never came to be. So those films weren't terrible. I think they're sort of looked back on now, especially among millennials, as, you know, they weren't terrible. They're kind of corny, kind of goofy, sort of, you know, classic superhero movies from that early 2000s era, where they've not quite become the cultural phenomenon that they are now. And there's a little bit more experimentation with what the superhero movies are and what they could do. But again, the diminishing returns sort of killed that. In 2015, there was a new version of the Fantastic Four, for 20th Century Fox, and that was helmed by Josh Trank. Josh Trank, who he did that the film Chronicle, which was really well received. It sort of put him on the map. Trank would go on and do the 2020 film Capone with Tom Hardy. But it was 2015's Fantastic Four that really did not bode well for his long-term career. He was originally going to be working on some Star Wars stuff as the Fantastic Four reviews were coming out. And, it, you know, between that and the stories of how he was on set, it just it snowballed, and he ended up not getting the Star Wars gig. But that film, the 2015 film, was sort of, it was universally hated. In my estimation, with the people I've talked to, my friends who are moviegoers and things like that, it is roundly considered the worst superhero film many of them have ever seen. It was a very dark, gritty reimagining of these characters that might have been interesting and ambitious in one sense, but was so out of touch, if you will, so at odds with the tone of these characters, that was so at odds with the, call it the spirit of these characters in the comic books, that it was pretty universally hated. And that was it. That was the last adaptation before Marvel finally managed to reacquire the rights to those characters. And it was the rights issues that kept them out of Marvel's hands for so long, but that all sort of changed back in the early 2020s when Marvel finally reacquired the rights to them, which has led to this new film. As far as what makes this one very different from those, you know, this one has this retro futuristic 1960s alternate universe aesthetic. The movie establishes that this version takes place on a separate Earth, Earth 828. In other words, it's not in the main MCU universe. So in that sense, it's detached from all the other MCU films, which, you know, for my money was kind of nice because I didn't feel like I was missing anything when I watched it. Think Jack Kirby meets 2001 A Space Odyssey is sort of the vibe of this film. And it sort of embraces that kind of space age whimsy and these very vivid color palettes and production designs. Unlike the 2005 and 2015 films, there is no origin story. The movie sort of begins, as you said, with the Fantastic Four already established. They're well into their careers. You sort of get this little bit of a retelling that plays out a bit like a fun sort of TV show montage of the origin story. But other than that, you're not going to spend time. The plot is not the origin story, if you will. Previous adaptations have leaned very heavily on Dr. Doom's popularity as the villain. But here, the antagonist is Galactus, and Silver Surfer, who's played by Julia Garner, is his herald. And so that shift kind of gives the film a bit of a cosmic stake and existential tone. It's, again, sort of like the comics, the grandeur of the comics, the zaniness of the comics. There's much more of a focus here on the characters having an emotional core, themes of parenthood. And it's a pretty tight, pretty self-contained story. It's under 2 hours, which I really appreciated. We sort of live in a very odd time where, you know, kids are watching TikTok videos and they can't hold their focus for more than a certain period of time. And yet the movies, the big blockbuster movies, will run, you know, 2 hours and 20 minutes, 2 hours, 30 minutes, 2 hours, 40 minutes. So it's always nice to see a major blockbuster movie know exactly what it's doing, you know, trim all the fat off. And I, for one, was a big fan. I was very relieved to see that, you know, I wasn't going to have to sit there for 3 hours by the time you get through the trailers and all of that. This one is a very faithful adaptation in terms of visuals, in terms of tone, in terms of storytelling. They take heavy inspiration from Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's original comics. In fact, there are certain shots in those montages that recreate iconic comic book covers from the 60s. Of course, only, you know, the hardcore fans are going to pick up on that. But there are several instances in this film where it feels like you're looking at the literal cover of an old school Fantastic Four comic book. So those are all some of the things that makes this movie, you know, pretty different. Skipping the origin story, the cosmic scale over the sense of grounded realism, anchoring the story in themes of family and very strong emotions, and then having these very strong performances in this highly stylized world all sort of gives this version of Fantastic Four its own unique identity.
If you've been listening to the past few episodes, you've heard me talking about the very special print edition of the Christian Research Journal that is the culmination of more than 1 year of primary research done by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff. And it is about this insidious cult in China called Eastern Lightning, which, as I noted last time, we did a news story on almost 20 years ago or more than 20 years ago. And it's also known as the Church of Almighty God. And this particular pseudo-Christian cult is following a self-proclaimed female Christ who actually has heretical doctrine that incites physical violence with its followers, and it has psychological intimidation, it disrupts families, and they literally have perpetrated physical assault. And for that reason, we do have a trigger warning note for some of the photos that we show. But it is a very deadly cult, and it is worldwide. It has worldwide followers of more than 10 million people. And so you won't want to miss out about this because it helps you understand what you believe and why you believe it and keep up with different religious movements that are very dangerous that need to be exposed like is done in this particular issue. So you won't want to miss out on it because we actually have it now in our hands and you will want a copy. So to get one, you would make a partnering gift with the Christian Research Journal at equip.org/donate. And please consider getting this in-depth special issue. It's going to be a collector's item, really, because it is really at the heart of all the things that we've done for decades at CRI, exposing these kinds of groups and doing the primary research. So please go to equip.org/donate, or on the front page, you will see a picture under resources, giving resources, and you can make a partnering gift for your copy. And now back to my conversation about Fantastic Four with Cole Burgett.
So of course, I'll say this to you, and we do it every episode of TV or movies, but there might be new listeners here. Is this a movie that you think Christians can see, and maybe some parents, because I did see some families in the theater when I went to see it. Is it something that parents can take their children to see?
Yeah, this one's a pretty safe one. And in fact, it may be interesting, some of the themes we can get into a little bit later, that makes this one Of the three big blockbusters we've talked about this summer, from Jurassic World to Superman to this one, there are maybe some themes and ideas that make this one the most compelling in terms of Christian viewers and things like that. But yeah, I think this is a film that Christians could see, Christian families can see. I would say it, in one sense, this movie is more palatable for everyday viewers, common viewers, than even Superman. Superman has, as we said, has a lot of that trademark James Gunn sense of humor. So it's very quirky. It's very zany. And this film is much more general audience focused than Superman. So yeah, I think this is a film that Christians can see, families can see, the kids can go. I was talking with one of my friends who took his family to see it on opening weekend. And one of the things we sort of touched on is that we could kind of see kids getting bored with this one a little bit, just because it's not that it doesn't have the big, you know, battle stuff or all the CGI that the, you know, comic book movies have. It's just that this movie is sort of a little more deliberately paced. A lot of the drama in this film comes from sort of the quieter emotional moments. There's a some infighting in the family and things like that, that, that create tension for the audience. But you can kind of see younger kids sort of getting bored with that kind of a thing. But other than that, yeah, there's nothing in this movie that stood out as, you know, jarring in any sort of way. So yeah, Christians can see it, families can see it. I think it could be just fine for that.
So why don't you give our listeners kind of a high overview of the plot? What is this particular movie, because it's based on comic books, what is this particular one about?
So this one, subtitled First Steps, which should give you a little hint about what the story is about, this theme of family is about. It follows the Fantastic Four, already well into their superhero journey, as we said, skipping the traditional origin story. And now Reed and Sue are expecting their first child. That child, of course, comic book fans will know as Franklin Richards. And, of course, Franklin in the comic books is one of the most, if not the most, powerful characters to ever appear on the pages of Marvel Comics. So the movie is about really this pregnancy that becomes the emotional and sort of the ethical center to the film. So this version of their Earth, this alternate Earth that they live on, is threatened by Galactus. Galactus is this massive cosmic entity that devours planets. It's sort of, Galactus is one of those characters that there's often been debate about, can you even adapt Galactus to a movie, because it only sort of works in the pages of comic books. But this movie pulls him off. And he has this very enigmatic alien herald called the Silver Surfer, here portrayed by Julia Garner. And Galactus demands Franklin. He demands this unborn child in exchange for sparing their Earth. And so the film is this, you know, really personal test of sacrifice and courage. And so at its heart, this film tackles themes of parenthood. It tackles themes of responsibility. It tackles themes of love, of sacrifice. Reed's fear that he'll, not only will he fail as a father, but that, you know, there might be something wrong with their child as a result of what happened to the family. Sue's willingness to sacrifice herself. All of those types of themes, all of those tensions ground this big cosmic spectacle in real emotional stakes. And then Franklin's birth and the aftermath add some real dramatic weight to the story. As we said before, this film has a very distinctive style visually and tonally. It is steeped in 1960s retrofuturism. There's these bright hues, there's period accurate costumes. There are production designs that nod to classic sci-fi. Think the Jetsons. Think those old Kirby comic book pages. So that sort of space age whimsy, those old space age movies, were very much an influence on this film's palette. And then, as we said before, this particular story, this version of the Fantastic Four, avoids broader MCU tie-ins and superhero cameos because it's set in an alternate timeline. And so it delivers this very self-contained narrative focused on its core ensemble, its pacing, focused on character chemistry. And there's a very real sense in which the drama of this film comes about almost as a disaster movie. Once Galactus shows up, the film almost becomes, I mentioned this in the review that I wrote, like a disaster flick. And so you've got this nice little marriage of the space age movies, a little bit like what you might think of as, you know, original series Star Trek aesthetics and vibes, Gene Roddenberry meeting with this disaster movie motif at one point, I kind of thought when Galactus is there stomping around, I was sort of like, oh, this is kind of like an old school Godzilla movie, where a lot of the drama is these really smart scientists trying to figure out how do we stop this, you know, cosmic level threat to our planet, our livelihoods. We're not just saving ourselves, we're kind of saving the world here. How do we do that? And so a lot of the drama in the film is, you know, did you call this person? What are these people saying? Are they going to be able to help us? We have to get all of these people together to build this giant thing to help us. So it's very different in that sense. And so this is a story that sort of reshapes that Fantastic Four narrative, at least that we've seen on movies, with a strong ensemble performance married to that kind of aesthetic. So that's a little bit about what this film's about.
In your article, you touch on some messianic imagery around Franklin Richards. In fact, that one of their key, I guess, worries about him while he's still in utero is, will this kid be a freak? Will he be normal? They're performing tests on him and so forth. Could you kind of unpack that for us? And did you think the filmmakers intentionally had this, oh, chosen one, chosen baby kind of theme in mind when they made this film?
Yeah, there's definitely some rich messianic imagery surrounding Franklin Richards in this movie. And I do think at least some of it is intentional, especially given the film's more reflective, character-driven tone. And the story itself never becomes overtly religious, but it does lean into a kind of cosmic mythology that invites those parallels. For starters, Franklin is positioned as a little bit of a child of promise before he's even born. There's this looming question of what kind of power he might hold, what he might mean to the universe, and whether his very existence could alter fate. That alone recalls a lot of messianic archetypes. Think of figures who are foretold, born into peril, whose arrival upends the world's balance. And in some ways, it's the closest Marvel will get to some theological language here. And of course, there's the sacrificial framework. Galactus demands the child in exchange for sparing Earth. It sort of casts Franklin as a potential savior and scapegoat. And of course, Galactus is doing this because he can sense, he can see and understand the power that Franklin is ultimately going to wield. And so it's not hard when you're watching Reed and Sue faced with these decisions. It's not hard to hear an echo of Isaac on the altar. Isaac, of course, who we would say is a Christ type. He is typologically a version of Christ, innocent, but carrying the weight of judgment and hope. And, you know, there will be spoilers here, so if you intend to see the movie and don't want to know what happens, and you know, it's probably best to stop listening, go watch, come back. But really the dramatic high point of the movie is that Sue ends up giving her own life for the child. It taps into this idea of maternal sacrifice, which the film plays with quite emotionally. You can almost sort of see this, you know, through a mirror darkly, a kind of Marvel Holy Family. And then, of course, after Sue is dead, the child resurrects her. And it's very eerie the way that it's portrayed.
It is. Was that a computer baby at the end? It's like they really had it seemed to me like a crying infant actor. And then all of a sudden, there he was on his, you know, mother's stomach and looking her into the eyes. And it seemed like eerie, kind of like AI type of thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of the stuff with Franklin was CG, if I'm not mistaken. It's been a minute since I've seen it. But the resurrection of Sue at the end, it did, and I thought this was very interesting, because I couldn't decide if it was intentional, which I think probably says more about the film than the audience, that this wasn't communicated clearly, or the ambiguity is the point. I haven't really been able to find anybody talking about that to know for sure. in terms of the filmmakers. But when I saw it in the theater, and you get the scene of the resurrection, where this infant resurrects his mother, it sort of comes across as weird. And it has that, you know, classic Marvel played for laughs, like he claps for himself at the end and it's cute and all of that. But the actual moment of the resurrection, maybe it's the music, maybe it's just the way that it's shot, but there's something very odd about it. It's not, I didn't get the sense that it was meant to be this, you know, great triumphant moment, because it was just so odd and eerie and almost, I don't want to say scary because it's not, but it's just, there's something feels off about it, and that you don't really, I didn't at least take it as very triumphant. And, you know, usually in theaters, especially on opening nights when I saw it, you know, comic book fans are very, you know, a rapturous bunch, and things like that elicit, you know, claps and people yelling and things like that. And none of that happened in that scene. It was, everybody I think was sort of, if you're reading the room, was kind of like, I'm not so sure this is a great thing. It was just an odd thing to see. But all of that to say, yes, the messianic imagery is, I think, intentional. And that does fit very nicely with what we know of Franklin in the comic books, who, as I said, you know, is sort of this legendarily powerful figure. And so I don't think the film is trying to preach anything specific, but it is clearly drawing from some deep mythological wells here, many of which, as we know and have talked about at length on this podcast, overlap with messianic themes. And it lends the film some emotional gravity. Franklin's birth isn't just a personal milestone for Reed and Sue, but it really is treated as a kind of cosmic event. I mean, he's born in space while they're trying to, you know, run from Galactus, and the Silver Surfer is pursuing them, and the Silver Surfer can warp reality. So, you know, the Silver Surfer's in the ship, and, you know, she's placing her hand on Sue's stomach, and Sue is screaming, "Killer, killer!" You know, it's pretty heightened drama there, as the child is being born in zero gravity, which is visually something I don't know that I've ever quite seen that done before. And that's exactly the kind of larger-than-life storytelling Fantastic Four has always done best. So whether or not it's explicitly theological, I would say the messianic imagery is deliberate, and in certain places it's quite effective. It helps lift the film from being just another, you know, superhero showdown to something a little more mythic and lasting.
So is there something there, like, you know, you just talked about, you know, does it have this messianic theme, and there's resurrection in the film? Are these some of the things that maybe the Christian apologists can think through as they approach this film? I mean, what are some additional themes that they can talk about with other people that see the film? Because I would think that today, more people see the film that are just, hey, let's go to the movies, as opposed to, I read the comic book series and now I've seen it. You know how people say, oh, I read The Hobbit, now I'm going to see it. I think less people have probably read the comics for the Fantastic Four than are going to see this movie.
Absolutely. I think you're right about that. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's rich veins for the apologist to tap. We've talked about the messianic vein, so I won't go too much into that. But adjacent to the messianic theme, I was struck by how pro-life this film is. Now, I should qualify this. We sort of said the same thing about Godzilla Minus One, right? It was a shockingly pro-life film, but in a very different sense. That film was not really politically motivated. It was a Japanese movie. It was far more interested in giving a commentary on the way that, you know, Japan historically had treated the lives of its soldiers as so expendable, that kind of a thing. So it was very much a, you know, a movie that loved life and saw value in life. This film in particular, Fantastic Four, pro-life in the sense of how we use it today. And I want to be very careful here, because I don't want to say that the filmmakers were intentionally trying to make political statements, because I actually don't think that was the case. But because it is tapping into this mythology and these mythological images, and the movie is sort of built around the birth of a child, it comes across a certain way. And I'm not the only person to think this. In fact, this was not the first thing I thought of in the movie. But when talking with one of my coworkers who saw it after, this coworker teaches Bible, particularly systematic theology. And in the systematic theology class, when they begin to study human life, one of the things that he said was the scene where Reed and Sue, they sort of use her powers. I think you'll probably remember this scene. It's been a little over a week, I guess, since I've seen it. But if you recall the scene where Sue sort of uses her powers, because she can turn invisible, to sort of show Reed the baby in the womb. It's a really jarring scene, right? And she sort of can use her powers and you see the child forming in the womb. My coworker said he absolutely cannot wait for this film to become widely available because he fully intends to show that scene as a way of introducing the discussion of human life. And of course, adjacent to that is the question of abortion and those sorts of topics that you ultimately get into, which are very, very hot button topics right now. But my coworker found that particular scene emotionally very powerful for those discussions. And so that's just one way that, you know, somebody who's not me, but who is involved in, you know, teaching the Bible and things like that, saw the film and said, that is a great way. That is a great way to move into this conversation about these kinds of theological topics and concerns and things like that. And it's also worth pointing out that after he saw that and we had that conversation, I said, you know, I understand where he's coming from, but I don't necessarily know that I would ascribe that to the film. I don't necessarily know that I would see it as deeply tied to serving that purpose as he did. And so I started looking. I thought, you know, let's see if there's other people who have other critics, other reviewers who have seen the film and have sort of caught the same observations. And sure enough, it was a very quick Google search. I did find one and I jotted the quote down. And the quote is this, I'll read it. The film is shockingly pro-life, which I definitely didn't have on my bingo card, even going to the point of showing an unborn child inside a womb in a way that is tremendously humanizing. And that reviewer, whose quote I just read, actually didn't really like the whole film. They didn't really like the movie as a whole. But that scene, whatever reason, resonated with them. And they kind of came to the conclusion, this is kind of a, you know, weirdly pro-life. And so that, I think, is a really good example of a scene in the movie outside of, you know, the whole messianic imagery, that sort of a thing. Because we're always talking, it feels like on this podcast, about, you know, the mythological angle. That is a very humanized scene in the film that several people have seen, said, that's a really interesting entry point into this discussion over here. But I think in that context, we have to be very careful and not say that, well, the filmmakers were very intentionally sitting down to make a movie about this and to make it extremely conservative and to make it, because I don't think at all that's what was happening. It just so happened that because they're playing with the messianic imagery, because they're playing with these mythological ideas, that they of course would end up including some kind of scene that comes across in that way, because all of those themes overlap. There is something sacred about human life. And when you begin to tap into mythological imagery, you cannot help but to start to go in those directions. And this is what we've talked about before on this podcast, where you can have a world that is in the throes of sin, that is in the throes of darkness and wanting nothing to do with the gospel. And yet in the stories we tell, there exists echoes of Eden. There exists a clear bend, especially in these stories, which lean heavily into mythology. And comic book movies do that all of the time. When it leans into the power of myth, and the mythic imagery that, of course, is all throughout the Bible. We've said a million times before on here, when we say myth in these conversations, we don't mean myth, i.e. fake or not scientific. We're saying mythic in the sense of there are common threads, common images, common motifs that transcend culture, that transcend periods of time. There are certain recurring design patterns, what we might call motifs, what in literature is sometimes called archetypes, And the Bible has them as well. In theological studies, we just talk about typology, right? You read the story of Isaac and you go, you read the story of Jesus and you go, they're kind of similar. You read the story of Moses and you read the story of Jesus and you go, they're kind of similar. And of course, in biblical studies and biblical theology, we would say those stories are anticipating Christ. They're pointing toward Christ. The New Testament writers come along and explain that. The writer of Hebrews will come along and explain that. And then on the flip side to that, you'll have these stories we continue to tell today, like Franklin Richards being born, that you look at and kind of go, it's a little messianic. It's kind of like that Jesus story back there. And you can't get away from that, the illusions, if you will. So outside of that, for once, here we have an example of a very, you know, humanized portrayal of a child inside the womb that really does come across as a certain way. And I think that's a pretty interesting angle into that conversation.
And like you're saying, I don't think that the filmmakers are trying to make political statements, but the way that they portray the Fantastic Four is very much like this nuclear family, and the parents love one another, and it's, you know, their family has its ups and downs, but they love one another. It's not this dark, like you said, gritty tone where everyone's orphaned or they're trying to make a created family or something like that. So I did think that for a blockbuster, that was different from the norm these days, kind of like when we talked about Andor's going that dark, gritty route. It's not this, okay, this is, and what were they trying to do that with that kind of stylized 1950s vibe to the film? Did they think that, well, this was kind of like this retro thing, so we'll go for a retro view of the family, perhaps?
Yeah, it's one of those where I wish the filmmakers would be a little more forthcoming, and maybe in years to come, in interviews and things like that, they will. I always try to be very careful ascribing to a movie, you know, intentionality in what is being done if it is not explicit in the narrative. And I think, you know, you're going to get some varying mileage in terms of who thinks, you know, this is sort of explicit and the film is intentionally doing this. But what can be said is that the film does include this kind of a thing. It doesn't really make some political statement on it. And yet the imagery is there and speaks for itself. Whether or not that was intentional on the part of the filmmaker is almost, it's almost a different conversation. But when it comes to questions of intentionality and is that the point of what you're looking at, you know, you're sort of going to have to say, well, short of having the person who made it sitting here talking to me, I won't be able to say for sure one way or the other. So always be careful when ascribing intentionality if you, you know, can't find an interview or something like that where the writer, the filmmaker talks about it. But beyond that, yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It does seem to be a very tame. I will use the word conservative, not to make any sort of political statement, but because the word itself, detached from the political sphere, it's a good word for explaining the film's approach to the family, for explaining their approach to the world that they've built. It is quite conservative in a lot of ways.
What do you think that this film means for the whole Marvel franchise? Because, you know, like you noted, first of all, the franchise, you know, it has its different ups and downs. Some of its films have been more successful and its TV shows, and others have been kind of bombs. I mean, we were talking about the Marvel film of Fantastic Four from 2015 that's totally bombed and was received very poorly. So do you think that this rejuvenates the brand? And actually, I was reading a piece somewhere, and I can't remember where they were saying, it's not that people don't like superhero movies, it's just that moviegoers want to see good movies. And some of the superhero movies we've been seeing are not very good movies.
Yeah, I think that's probably the better thing to say. And we've talked about that a little bit here, where there you'll sort of get these ideas of franchise fatigue that float around out there. But then you look at the money that a Jurassic World is making, you look at the money that a Superman or a Fantastic Four is making, you go, well, it's if people are burned out on franchises, they picked a weird time to show up in droves and pay all of this money. I mean, people have spent a lot of money going to the movies in the month of July 2025. And all of the big blockbusters are franchise movies. So, you know, it's not so much franchise fatigue, I think, as it is just bad movie fatigue, which has always sort of been the case. I think there's certainly a room within that conversation to say, okay, too much too soon is not the best idea, i.e. Star Wars. But it's not that people are just abandoning franchises left and right. That's not happening. As far as what this means for the MCU as a whole, I don't think it's any stretch to say that since the last film of that original storytelling arc, the Endgame or whatever it was called, those movies, the MCU has kind of been in a bit of a slump. There's a sense of which, you know, they haven't really had a solid direction. I know that they had a big villain that they were trying to push as the next Thanos, but then there was, you know, behind the scenes, real world stuff where he was arrested or something like that. I hope I didn't get that wrong. I just know that there was major drama. There were accusations against him and they dropped him. Long story short, he was no longer the big bad. They had to come up with a new one. And the new one is Dr. Doom, who is a Fantastic Four character and is now apparently played by Robert Downey Jr., who used to play Iron Man. So that there's a lot of, you know, speculation surrounding that.
Are you talking about Peter Miller? Is that who you're talking about?
No. Jonathan Majors. It was Jonathan Majors, who was originally slated to play Kang, the Conqueror. And, you know, he appeared in one or two of the movies. He was, I think he appeared in Ant-Man and the Wasp, one of those. And then I think maybe he was in Loki. But if I recall correctly, it was a couple years ago, as all these movies were coming out, it was the year that all that was coming out. He was arrested for physical assault. He was tried that year and, you know, found guilty. I think it was on misdemeanor accounts. And he was dropped from numerous projects, including any future involvement with the MCU. So they were very intentionally setting up Kang as the new villain. And then in the middle of all of that, after the ball had started rolling, all of that happened. And they dropped him. So they had to have a new direction. And that kept them in a slump for a few years. But now it looks like they finally got Dr. Doom as their big bad. They're going to set that up. Fantastic Four obviously plays a huge role in that. So I do think in that sense, this new film, The Fantastic Four, it does sort of herald, if not a new beginning, it heralds maybe a bit of a resurgence in the MCU. The question is, will the audience be there for it? And I don't know that the audience, I don't know that those movies will ever find the audience that they had formerly with that original batch of 20-some films leading up to Infinity War and Endgame and all of that. But it's certainly, if the films going forward can maintain the quality of this one, I think that it probably bodes well for them.
Well, finally, on, I don't know that I would say it's a lighter note, but an adjacent note for Cole, I would like to ask him about the comic books, because we were talking about earlier in this podcast that more people will see this film than read the comic books. So maybe for some parents that have fond memories of, you know, picking up a comic book, you know, old school in a comic book store or something like that, what would you recommend for Marvel? Would it be starting here with the Fantastic Four or something else that maybe we can get some younger kids who aren't interested in reading more excited about reading by picking up a comic book? And also, are they appropriate? We talked about how this film is appropriate. I just don't know enough about comic books to know. Are those, you know, PG-13, PG, rated R?
As far as, you know, if you're trying to get into Marvel, so here's how I'll answer this. There are certain key iconic story arcs in comic books, period. And most casual comic book readers will have read the major arcs. In DC, it would be something like, you know, the death of Superman or, you know, the crisis events. In Marvel, the death of Gwen Stacy, Spider-Man. There, again, there are just certain arcs that people know because they have a very legendary status. But as far as starting with Marvel, I would say two things. I would say one, and this is the advice I usually give, don't go in looking for an arc because that varies. Certain things people like more than others. My advice has always been to find a writer that you like. There are so many writers in comic books and they're always moving off of different books and onto others. And so in the comic book world, we call them runs. You know, John Byrne's run on Superman, Scott Snyder's run on Batman. And that's just the Batman story as told by that writer. Now, yes, Tom King, for example, will come along after Scott Snyder, and he will do Batman completely differently. And don't really worry too much about the continuity between their runs. There's going to be some, there might not be. It's just part of how it goes. So my advice has always been to find a writer that you like and read that writer's stuff. Go to some of those books and read their runs on some of those books. And I would say with Marvel, Brian Michael Bendis is a very well-known Marvel comic book writer that you could check out. As far as, since we're talking about Fantastic Four, there are a handful of very iconic Fantastic Four runs. Mark Millar, M-I-L-L-A-R. Mark Millar's run on Fantastic Four. Dan Slott's run on Fantastic Four. Mark Waid is another very well-known comic book writer, W-A-I-D. Jonathan Hickman, John Byrne, also had a Fantastic Four run. So it's, again, all of those really well-known creators, hot books. So my advice is to find a writer that you like and follow their titles.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 457 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written a film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Family First, a film review of the Fantastic Four First Steps. And you can read Cole's review completely free without a paywall at equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.